Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1075, Surveillance Valley Part 1, Eugenics, Racism, and High Tech. This is being recorded on June 11th of the year 2019. In this program, we're going to begin an examination of information from a book that, while I could not and would not say is the most important book I've ever read, or perhaps the most important book ever written, that would be a preposterous claim. However, I will say that this book is as important a book as I have ever read. It is as important a book as I think has ever been written. And I will say that reading this book should be regarded as mandatory for anyone who wishes to truly understand the world in which they are living. I want to stress that I am not in any way profiting from this. We're going to begin looking at the book itself, but we're going to begin with an article by the author of the book. The book that will occupy our attention for some time is Surveillance Valley, subtitled The Secret Military History of the Internet by Yasha, Y-A-S-H-A, Levine, capital L-E-V-I-N-E. This book talks about the internet and its origins and its military foundation. Beyond that, it takes a look at the technologies that have been marketed to people as wonderful, liberating entities, and the so-called privacy advocates and the so-called privacy organizations that have been lauded as sort of internet superheroes guarding the privacy of the average citizen against the prying eyes of the government, unquote. And as we will see, the very organizations, the very individuals, people like Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, people like Jacob Applebaum, institutions like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, institutions like the Tor Network, are inextricably linked with the very forces that they would have us believe they oppose. In the case of some of these organizations, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I don't doubt that many of the individuals are sincere in their advocacy for privacy, and yet, as we will see, the very privacy industry and the technologies are inextricably linked with the very government and the very intelligence services they would have us believe they work against. And beyond that, those intelligence services and the government and the privacy organizations and the individuals like Jacob Applebaum, WikiLeaks, Eddie the Friendly Spook, Snowden et al. Are inextricably linked with the big tech companies. I was going to talk some more about Ukraine and the leaderless resistance strategy. However, I think I'm going to go back into that after this series. Again, the book Surveillance Valley, subtitled The Secret Military History of the Internet by Yasha Levine, is a must read if one wishes to understand what is actually going on in today's world. And the internet is part of all of our lives, for better or worse. You must read this book. So please get the book, read it, tell other people about it, tell them to get it, have them read it, have them tell others. I get no money whatsoever from this. However, understanding the information in this book is fundamental to an understanding of our world. And before any problem can be solved, it must be accurately understood. What we're going to begin with, however, before we get to the internet per se, is to take a look at eugenics, the development of IBM, the Hollerith machine, racism, and high tech. Indeed, the subtitle of the program is Eugenics, Racism, and High Tech. Here in the year of our Lord 2019, we are hearing all about immigration and immigrants and how we've got to do something about that. And it is not just in this country, but around the world. As I looked at in 1013, in fact, and we came back to this, by the way, in 1039, the issue of immigration, the issue of eugenics and fascism are inextricably linked. And as we will see in this program, the issues of eugenics, racism, and immigration are in turn inextricably linked not only with the history of fascism itself, but with high tech. And we're going to begin with an article by Yasha Levine, not from his book Surveillance Valley, but from the 01 blog of April 28th of 2018. This is titled "The Racist Origins of America's Tech Industry" by Yasha Levine, and it talks about a fellow named Hermann, H-E-R-M-A-N, Hollerith, H-O-L-L-E-R-I-T-H, and it talks about how he was recruited by Tsar Nicholas II of Russia in the late 19th century to use his new technology to compile an accurate census of the many people and the many different kinds of people who were subsumed under the rule of the Russian Empire. Then, after talking about that, Yasha Levine goes on to write, "A few years earlier, working for the U.S. Census Bureau, Hollerith had developed the world's first functional mass-produced computer, the Hollerith Tabulator, an electromechanical device about the size of a large desk and dresser. It used punch cards and a clever arrangement of gears, sorters, electrical contacts, and dials to process data with blazing speed and accuracy. What had taken years by hand could be done in a matter of months. As one U.S. newspaper described it, quote, with the device's aid, some 15 young ladies can count accurately 500,000 names in a day, unquote. Russia was not the only country interested in Hollerith's computer technology. He had set up shop in New York just a few years earlier, but was already known in verified bureaucratic circles around the globe. Canada, Germany, and Norway were eager to lease his machines. A company in Austria was trying to pirate his designs and offer them to European governments at a lower cost. Hollerith's tabulators could work with any kind of data and adapt to any large information-intensive corporate enterprise. Railroad and insurance companies were lining up outside Hollerith's door for their own custom-built data solutions. Hollerith's invention caught the zeitgeist of the Second Industrial Revolution, a time of rapid automation and mechanization. It was an era of railroads, giant steamerships, telegraphs, radio, electricity, massive factories, and unprecedented real-time international communication. Shipping schedules, train timetables, complex banking data, actuary tables, social welfare programs, and government budgets were all proliferating faster than humans could keep track of them. Information was king, and data processing was in constant demand. Within a few years, Horowitz was the multimillionaire owner of a company that would eventually launch the U.S. computer industry. A few decades after returning from Russia, his technology would form the backbone of International Business Machines, or IBM, a global conglomerate that for almost a century would be synonymous with information processing and computer technology. Sold under IBM's brand name, Horowitz technology would power civilian governments, militaries, and corporations around the world, crunching numbers into the Cold War and all the way to the dawn of the Internet in the 1960s. The world did not simply use Horowitz tabulators. It became addicted to them and was shaped by them. Horowitz was hailed as a genius. Many believed his invention was part of a larger, data-driven technology revolution that would lead to a better, more efficient, and more harmonious world. One leading American statistician predicted it would usher in an age of, quote, universal justice, unquote, and, quote, make international wars impossible, unquote. But for all the utopian talk about Horowitz computers, the technology had dark roots. And then the next section is called Dreaming of Making America Great Again. The U.S. Census, specifically mandated by the Constitution to take place every 10 years, is back in the news not only because the next count kicks off in 2020, but because, as it has often been in the past, the census is a political flashpoint with inevitable racial overtones. The current controversy revolves around a plan devised by Donald Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census form. On the surface, it seems like an inconsequential detail, but there is wide agreement that adding it will have profound political implications for a decade to come. Aggregated population data provided by the census is a critical component in our democratic system. Its most important function is to apportion congressional representation for the coming decade, but it also determines the structure of the Electoral College and guides the distribution of hundreds of billions in federal spending. Objections to the addition of a citizenship question are based on concerns about undercounting. The fear, widely shared by former census officials, is that asking people for their citizenship status will push some immigrants and Latinos to avoid taking part in the census altogether. A large enough undercount of a specific minority or socioeconomic group will skew how seats are apportioned in the House of Representatives, shifting political power and federal resources away from districts where these groups reside. The Trump administration has claimed that the citizenship question is being added for a good cause, to help the federal government enforce the Voting Rights Act and protect minorities from voter discrimination. But many immigrant advocates don't buy this logic. They see the citizenship question as part and parcel of Trump's larger anti-immigrant agenda. For most of its history, the census and the constitutionally mandated government bureaucracy that carries it out has been intertwined with nativism, bigotry, and fear of, quote, the other, unquote. Arturo Vargas, V-A-R-G-A-S, Executive Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, put it this way. The decision by Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross to force the last-minute addition of an untested question on citizenship will result in an undercount of Latinos. While we do not know the true motivation behind these actions, we know the impact. As a consequence of these actions, Census 2020 is on track to significantly undercount the Latino population in the U.S. Others are more direct. Our president, the face of our federal government which oversees the census, has based his candidacy on a deeply anti-immigrant platform, unquote, says Betsy Plum, P-L-U-M, vice president of policy at the New York Immigration Coalition, one of the organizations trying to stop the Trump administration from adding the question. Quote, what the citizenship question did was it took a much broader fear and focused it right onto the census. The risk to a place like New York's congressional representation cannot be understated, unquote. Demographic shifts are already expected to result in northeastern states losing several congressional seats, and the added question may make the situation worse. I think this is absolutely the intent of really weaponizing the census against immigrant communities. Places like New York and places like California are very much the target, unquote. But there is another, less discussed dimension to the issue. Based on a close reading of internal Department of Commerce documents tied to the census citizen question proposal, it appears that the Trump administration wants to use the census to construct a first-of-its-kind citizenship registry for the entire U.S. population, a decision that arguably exceeds the legal authority of the census. One more time. But there is another, less discussed dimension to the issue. Based on a close reading of internal Department of Commerce documents tied to the census citizen question proposal, it appears that the Trump administration wants to use the census to construct a first-of-its-kind citizenship registry for the entire U.S. population, a decision that arguably exceeds the legal authority of the census. And note this, because we're going to come back to this, in the context not only of early 20th century U.S., but Nazi Germany as well. Quote, it was deep in the documentation that was released, unquote, Robert Groves, a former Census Bureau director who headed the National Academies Committee convened to investigate the 2020 census, told me by telephone. Again, it was deep in the documentation that was released, unquote, Robert Groves, G-R-O-V-E-S, a former Census Bureau director who headed the National Academies Committee convened to investigate the 2020 census, told me by telephone. No one picked up on that much, but the term registry in our world means not a collection of data for statistical purposes, but rather to know the identity of particular people in order to use that knowledge to affect their lives, unquote. Given the administration's posture toward immigration, the fact that it wants to build a comprehensive citizenship database is highly concerning. To Groves, it clearly signals, quote, a bright line being crossed, unquote. Multiple states have challenged the Trump administration's plans, and their lawsuits are headed to the Supreme Court, which is scheduled to hear the case in April. Meanwhile, at an oversight hearing in March, Democratic U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dug into Wilbur Ross, Trump's multimillionaire Secretary of Commerce, who oversees the U.S. Census Bureau. She accused him of conspiring with nativists and white supremacists to add the citizenship question and of overstepping his authority. Why are we violating law to include this question? She demanded. Whatever the courts ultimately decide, the latest debate over the census is hardly new. For most of its history, the census and the constitutionally mandated government bureaucracy that carries it out has been intertwined with nativism, bigotry, and fear of the other, unquote. The dark and ugly history of the census makes it a uniquely telling weather vane of race politics in America. That the census simultaneously played a central role in the development of the computer age more than 130 years ago makes it doubly relevant, offering a glimpse into how computers, surveillance, and racist government policies have been linked from the very beginning. Governments, next section is called Counting for Democracy. Governments have been counting their people since the beginning of recorded history. You can find descriptions of censuses in the Old Testament on Sumerian cuneiform tablets and in the writings of the ancient Greeks. There were censuses in pre-modern Europe. Most American colonies kept population records as well. Government counted people for two main reasons: A, raising state revenue, and B, waging war. They needed to know who and what to tax, and they needed to know how many fighting-age men could be mobilized. It was the U.S. Constitution that added a third and novel reason for counting people: representational democracy. When the drafters of the U.S. government's founding set of principles met in Philadelphia in 1787, one of the first things they hammered out was a clause mandating that the population be counted every 10 years. This directive for a decennial census appears up at the top of the Constitution long before the document gets around to laying out the structure of the government. To the framers of the Constitution, the census came first because it determined taxation and the balance of congressional political power. Under the Constitution, the number of seats in the House of Representatives apportioned to each state would be based on population, which meant the government needed to know the precise number of people living in each state. By the end of the 1800s, the bureaucratic problem had become untenable. The census was taking nearly 10 years to complete, meaning the results were outdated even before they came in. The first census took place in 1790 and was overseen by Thomas Jefferson, who was then serving as Secretary of State. It was mostly a straightforward headcount designed to meet the constitutional mandate. The whole enterprise was expected to take no more than 9 months to complete, but despite its simplicity and our nation's tiny population, it took nearly 2 years to fully tabulate, and it only got worse from there. With every passing decade, the census took longer to complete. It was filled with errors and undercounts, which led to nasty scandals and accusations that the data was being manipulated for political ends. By the end of the 1800s, the bureaucratic problem had become untenable. The census was taking nearly 10 years to complete, meaning the results were outdated even before they came in. When the first census was carried out, there were 3.9 million people living in 13 states. By 1890, the U.S. encompassed 42 states and had a population of 63 million, increasing 16 times over the span of a century. Never before had a country swelled so much so quickly. Still doing their work the old-fashioned way with pen and paper, census workers struggled to keep up. they were drowning in Baton. Meanwhile, on top of having to enumerate a rapidly growing population, government officials began to cram the census with more and more questions. Data on occupations, literacy levels, criminal histories, medical conditions, home ownership, economic trends, and a whole lot of probing about people's race and immigration status. As the 19th century drew to a close, census officials had started transforming what should have been a simple headcount into a system of racial surveillance. And then the next section is called Anglo-American Superiority. It was a different U.S. back then, smaller and mostly rural and rapidly expanding along the western frontier. The Civil War had come to an end, and with it, the U.S. Army shifted its resources to fighting and exterminating Native Americans west of the Mississippi. Transcontinental railroads were connecting huge swaths of the country, shrinking time and space and shifting economic power to a new set of financial and railroad business elites. The country's demographics and race politics were rapidly changing as well. Slavery had been abolished, allowing millions of blacks to freely move, attempt to take charge of their own destinies, and play a role in the country's political life. Immigration was making itself felt as well. Well into the 19th century, free immigration into the U.S. had been largely dominated by English settlers. But starting in the 1850s, that pattern began changing drastically. Millions of Irish peasants streamed into the country to escape the potato famine, which killed over 1 million people. Millions more were fleeing the crushing poverty of southern Italy and the eastern territories of the Russian Empire, and Chinese laborers were arriving on the West Coast en masse to build U.S. railroads. This influx was a boon to an emerging industrial oligarchy, a source of never-ending cheap labor. But it was also a source of political instability. Widespread inequality and exploitation led to massively popular movements for change. There were labor protests and strikes, the emergence of the populist movement, and a nationwide self-help organization created by dirt-poor farmers. Socialist and anarchist ideas achieved broad adherence. Black civil rights activism emerged as well. America's political establishment looked on this instability, social unrest, and change with horror. They saw the masses of free blacks and Chinese, Jewish, Irish, and Italian immigrants and their tattered clothes, alien languages, unnatural religions, and demands for better treatment and political rights as a threat. Grasping about for solutions, many settled on various strains of race science quackery. So-called social Darwinists relied on a twisted version of the theory of evolution to explain why the poor and marginalized should remain that way, while the wealthy and successful deserve to rule unchallenged. Taking this notion a step further, adherents of eugenics fervently believed that naturally superior Anglo-Americans were on the verge of being wiped out due to the high birth rates of, quote, degenerate, unquote, and immigrant stock. To head off this threat, they advocated strict controls on reproduction, breeding humans for quality in the same way that farmers did cows and horses. These were not fringe ideas, but were firmly embraced by the American cultural and political mainstream. From future presidents like Theodore Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, and Calvin Coolidge, to robber barons like J.P. Morgan and Leland Stanford, to writers like H.G. Wells and progressive activists like Margaret Sanger, eugenics was all the rage. In the first decades of the 20th century, 32 states passed sterilization laws to deal with the threat of genetic degradation, laws that were upheld by the Supreme Court. And few worried more about the threat of genetic degradation than the officials at the U.S. Census Bureau. The next section is called Purity Police. Born into a wealthy Boston family, Francis A. Walker served in the Civil War as a general, dabbled in journalism, and ultimately made a name for himself as an influential progressive-era economist and statistician who would later become president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. As a professional economist, Walker had a keen interest in the nation's changing demographics, and he was horrified by what he saw. Like most upper-class Americans at the time, Walker believed that the country's original English colonists had evolved to be the most superior race on the planet, superior even to the original English race from which they sprang. To him, Anglo-Americans stood on the pinnacle of the world's race pyramid. He and his people were, quote, as far ahead of the English as the English were ahead of any other branch of the Teutonic race, which was in turn far ahead of the Slavs or the Celts, unquote, he wrote. He believed that the influx of poor immigrants from Ireland and Italy, as well as Jews and Slavs from Eastern Europe, was diluting the U.S.'s superior racial stock and threatening to drag American genetic superiority back into a cesspool of degradation and decline. He blamed these immigrants, vast hordes of brutalized peasants, unquote, for the political and social unrest that was happening around him. Quote, they are beaten men from beaten races, representing the worst failures of all in the struggle for existence, he declared. They have none of the ideas and none of the aptitudes which fit men to take up readily and easily the problems of self-care and self-government, unquote. He not only pushed to restrict immigration in order to prevent what he viewed as Anglo-American, quote, race suicide, unquote, but also advocated forced sterilization, quote, we must strain out of the blood of the race more of the taint inherited from a bad and vicious past, he wrote. The scientific treatment which is applied to physical diseases must be extended to mental and moral disease, and a wholesome surgery and cautery must be enforced by the whole power of the state for the good of all, unquote. In addition to his other contributions to U.S. life, Walker served as superintendent of both the 1870 and 1880 U.S. Census. Next section, Limits of Technology. The census had been a racial instrument from its inception, beginning with the original constitutional clause that instructed census officials to count black slaves separately from whites and to assign them a value of only 3/5 of a person. With each decade, new, quote, racial, unquote, categories were invented and added to the mix, quote, free colored males and females, unquote, and, quote, mulatto, unquote, were counted, including subdivisions like, quote, quadroon, unquote, and, quote, octoroon, unquote. Categories for Hindu, H-I-N-D-O-O, Chinese, and Japanese were added, as were, quote, foreign, unquote, and native-born, unquote, designations for whites. The census slowly expanded to collect other demographic data, including literacy levels, unemployment statistics, and medical ailments, such as those who were deaf, dumb, and blind, unquote, and the, quote, insane and idiotic, unquote. All of it was broken down by race. Most of these questions were included in a haphazard fashion. They were overtly political, added in response to whatever particular racial fear gripped the national ruling elite at that time. One more time, this last couple of sentences. Most of these questions were included in a haphazard fashion. They were overtly political, added in response to whatever political racial fear gripped the national ruling elite at the time. The census needed to improve drastically. What it needed was a talented inventor, someone young and ambitious who would be able to come up with a method to automate tabulation and data analysis. Someone like Herman Hollerith. A racial category for Chinese was added after railroad companies began importing cheap, exploitable laborers from China. Categories for mulatto, unquote, came after the abolition of slavery caused a panic about the dangers of racial mixing. Questions about mental health and race were first added at the behest of a Southern senator right before the outbreak of Civil War. The results seemed to show that free blacks living in northern states were on average 11 times more likely to be insane than southern blacks living in slavery. Such questionable statistics were taken up by southern politicians to bolster racist theories and argue against abolition. To Walker, these early efforts didn't go nearly far enough. As an economist and statistician, he wanted to collect and process more data and to professionalize and standardize the effort. He wanted it to be a proper, scientific national inventory, unquote, not a haphazard collection of facts. But his dreams kept running up against a hard limit, technology. The census was still counted and analyzed by hand. The work was slow and limited. Sophisticated analysis was next to impossible. The census needed to improve drastically. What it needed was a talented inventor, someone young and ambitious, who would be able to come up with a method to automate tabulation and data analysis. Someone like Herman Hollerith. And then talking about his background. In 1879, when he graduated from the Columbia School of Mines with a degree in engineering, he was immediately recruited to help compile economic statistics for the 1880 census, which was being run by Walker. At his new job, Hollerith, who had developed a reputation as an inventive engineer in college, was encouraged by senior census officials to study the enumeration process and come up with a solution to speed it up. After the 1880 census was complete, he quit his job for a teaching position at MIT, following Walker, who had recently been appointed president. Hollerith kept tinkering with his invention, and before long, he came up with a design that separated the enumeration process into parts. The first involved converting data into a format that could be read by a machine. This he accomplished by punching holes on a piece of paper. The second step involved processing the data. This was accomplished by feeding the paper through a machine that, through a combination of pins and dials, read the numbers and position of the holes. At first, Hollerith experimented with using a continuous strip of paper like the recent invention of ticker tape, which was widely used to transmit stock prices via telegraph. But he was not happy with the results. The trouble was that if, for example, you wanted any statistics regarding Chinamen, you would have to run miles of paper to count a few Chinamen, Hollerith later explained in a letter. Race was never far from his mind when working on his contraption. He eventually hit upon a much better idea. Each person would be represented by their own punch card, an idea he picked up while riding on a train. I was traveling in the West, and I had a ticket with what I think was called a punch photograph. The conductor punched out a description of the individual as light hair, dark eyes, large nose, etc., he explained, noting that he'd simply done the same thing. In March of 1980, Hollerith's machines were installed at the Interocean Building on 9th Street in Washington, D.C., not far from the White House. He oversaw the installation himself, running around and barking orders to workmen who were hoisting creaky wooden crates from the street to the third floor. Last sentence again. In March of 1890, Hollerith's machines were installed at the Interocean Building on 9th Street in Washington, D.C., not far from the White House. He oversaw the installation himself, running around and barking orders to workmen who were hoisting creaky wooden crates from the street to the third floor. Soon, the property was transformed from a nondescript office space into the bustling headquarters of the 11th Census. Hundreds of clerks worked around the clock in shifts, taking raw census data collected in the field and transferring it onto cards using specifically designed hole-punch machines, and then passing the cards to another set of clerks who worked the tabulators and sorters. Hollerith's machines clanked away all day and all night, with clerks crammed together like sweatshop workers. Newspapers sent their correspondents to gawk at these futuristic contraptions. Because of the miserable track record of earlier censuses, the press was awash with predictions of incompetence and failure. They were wrong. It would take a full 4 years to finish and release the reports. It was an amazing improvement over the previous census, which took nearly a decade. The 1890 census, the nation's 11th, was the most ambitious yet. It contained 35 questions, 10 more than the previous census, on a whole range of data, literacy levels, sizes of household, professions, the value of a family's property, and whether they rented or owned. Perhaps most important was the racial dimension of the question. The census collected statistics on Native and foreign-born Americans and broke them into multiple racial categories: white, colored, Chinese, Japanese, and civilized Indian, i.e. a Native American no longer living in a tribal society. It was the first census to include a complete count of Native Americans living on tribal lands. It asked for data on unemployment history, fertility rates, citizenship status, criminal history, literacy, and English language proficiency. Despite the long list of questions and requirements for calculating a whole slew of new stats, including birth, unemployment, and causes of death divided up by race, the basic population count was completed in just 6 weeks. It would take a full 4 years to finish tabulating and editing all other categories of data and release the reports. It was an amazing improvement over the previous census, which took nearly a decade. It wasn't just the speed that set Hollerith's invention apart. It was its ability to mine and sift through data and even combine multiple data points. Such fine-grained analysis on a mass scale was completely unprecedented, and it made Hollerith machines an immediate hit with the United States' race-obsessed political class. Robert Porter, P-O-R-T-E-R, head of the 1890 census, who had overseen the adoption of Hollerith's tabulator machines, was deeply impressed by their power to sort immigrant and non-white populations based on numerous demographic variables. He was particularly pleased about being able to analyze the three things most feared by the race: suicide crowd, immigration rates, immigrant fertility rates, and mixed-race marriages, or what the census called the, quote, conjugal condition, unquote, all of which could be broken down by age, race, literacy levels, and naturalization status. Simon Newton Dexter North, a longtime wool industry lobbyist who would head the 1900 census, was also dazzled by the power of Hollerith's tabulators. Like Walker and other census colleagues, he was obsessed with immigration and cross-breeding. He believed they were diluting the country's superior Anglo-American stock and destabilizing society as a result. North believed that bureaucrats and statisticians like him were fighting a new kind of war, a war for America's genetic purity. And Hollerith's tabulator technology was a vital weapon, unquote, epic-making, unquote, invention, without which this fight would be lost. Next section, Feeding the Nativist Beast. Overnight, Hollerith's tabulator technology had transformed census-taking from a simple head count into something that looked very much like a crude form of mass surveillance. To the race-obsessed political class, it was a revolutionary development. They could finally put the nation's ethnic makeup under the microscope. The data seemed to confirm the nativists' worst fears. Poor, illiterate immigrants were swarming America's cities, breeding like rabbits and outstripping native Anglo-American birth rates. This last couple of sentences again. The data seemed to confirm the nativists' worst fears. Poor, illiterate immigrants were swarming America's cities, breeding like rabbits and outstripping native Anglo-American birth rates. Immediately following the census, the states and the federal government passed a flurry of laws that heavily restricted immigration. Again, immediately following the census, that's of 1890, the states and the federal government passed a flurry of laws that heavily restricted immigration. It started with the Immigration Act of 1891, which set up the first federal agency to oversee immigration and border control, and turned an unused island on the southern tip of Manhattan into an elaborate screening center for immigrants. It continued through the passage of a half dozen major immigration bills, including one that stripped women of U.S. citizenship if they married non-naturalized foreigners, culminating in the Immigration Act of 1924, a landmark piece of legislation that introduced race immigration quotas. This suite of laws gave immigration officials the power to ban just about anyone, including idiots, imbeciles, and feeble-minded persons, unquote, or those who exhibited, quote, constitutional psychopathic inferiority, unquote, or were, quote, mentally or physically defective, unquote. Anarchists and socialists were banned outright, as was anyone from the, quote, Asiatic Barred Zone, unquote, which included most of Asia, the subcontinent, the Middle East, and parts of Eastern Russia. Meanwhile, immigration from European countries was constrained by hard limits based on the 1890 census, the first census processed by Hollerith technology. combined with the anti-Chinese bills passed in the late 19th century, these laws created a virtual wall around the U.S. immigration rate. One more time. Meanwhile, combined with the anti-Chinese bills passed in the late 19th century, these new laws created a virtual wall around which the U.S. immigration rates plunged. North dreamed of a day when detailed racial data could be collected and analyzed for the whole world and used to guide genetic development. His dream would soon be realized in Europe. The data provided by Hollerith's invention did not cause the racism, nativism, and eugenics that saw class and poverty through the lens of breeding rather than politics and economic policy, but it gave these fears concrete shape and it provided data to which these fears could be hitched. To some U.S. bureaucrats, this data-driven eugenics system was just the beginning. North, who directed the U.S. Census Bureau from 1903 to 1909, dreamed of the day when detailed racial data could be collected and analyzed for the whole world and be used to guide human genetic development. Quote, "The need for restraining the genetically deficient classes and families from the function of reproduction is recognized as imperative," he wrote in 1918 from his perch at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as World War I was coming to an end. Quote, "It is the dream of the true statistician that the day will sometime arrive when the facts of demography will be available on identical bases for the entire globe. When that dream is realized, when comparable international statistics actually and everywhere exist, then we shall know the laws which determine human progress and can effectively apply them." His dream would soon be realized in Europe. Then Hollerith goes global. The immediate success of his invention made Hollerith wealthy and famous. But that was just the beginning. In 1911, he sold his tabulating machine company for $2.3 million to Charles Flint, an infamous venture capitalist known to his day as the father of trusts, unquote. Flint bought out Hollerith, combined his company with several other businesses that made precision mechanical contraptions, clocks, cash registers, coffee grinders, and butcher scales to create a computational monopoly and handed this new conglomerate over to an ambitious young executive by the name of Thomas J. Watson. And then after talking about work that the IBM company did for the Social Security Administration and other growing federal bureaucracies that demanded data processing on a massive scale, and talking about the application of IBM to the industrial infrastructure in World War II, Yasha Levine goes on to say, "Following the attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Census Bureau hauled out the punch cards from the 1940 census and reprocessed them to produce block-by-block population lists on Japanese Americans in a half-dozen states, including California. Ultimately, 130,000 Japanese Americans were forced to move to concentration camps." And skipping down again, Nazis and numbers. Hollerith tabulators were a big hit all over the world. But one country was particularly enamored with them, Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler came to power on the back of the economic devastation that followed Germany's defeat in World War I. To Hitler, however, The problem plaguing Germany was not economic or political, it was racial, and as he put it in Mein Kampf, the state is a racial organism and not an economic organization, unquote. The reason Germany had fallen so far, he argued, was its failure to tend to its racial purity. There were only about 500,000 Jews in Germany in 1933, less than 1% of the population, but he singled them out as the root cause of all of the nation's problems. Hitler and the Nazis drew much of their inspiration from the U.S. eugenics movement and the system of institutional racism that had arisen in slavery's wake. Their solution was to isolate the so-called mongrels, then continuously monitor the racial purity of the German people to keep the Volk free of further contamination. The only problem, how to tell who is really pure and who is not. The U.S. had a ready solution. IBM's German subsidiary landed its first major contract the same year Hitler became chancellor. The 1933 Nazi census was pushed through by Hitler as an emergency, genetic stock-taking of the German people. Along with other numerous data points, the census focused on collecting fertility data for German women, particularly women of good Aryan stock. Also included in the census was a special count on religiously observant Jews, or Glaubensjuden. Nazi officials wanted the entire count, estimated to be about 65 million people, to be done in just 4 months. It was a monumental task, and German IBM officials worked around the clock to finish it. So important was the success of the contract to IBM that CEO Thomas J. Watson personally toured the giant Berlin warehouse where hundreds of female clerks worked in rotating 7-hour shifts 24 hours a day. Watson came away greatly impressed with the work of his German managers. They had pulled off a seemingly impossible assignment, one that was complicated by a custom enlarged punch card format necessary for political reconsiderations, unquote. IBM's coded explanation for the extra data demands the Nazi regime required. As Hitler's Nazi Party tightened its grip on Germany, it launched all sorts of additional data-gathering programs to purify the German nation, and IBM helped them do it. And then the article goes on to talk about something we have spoken about in the past, namely the role of the Holorith machines in the racial extermination programs of Nazi Germany, in particular their liquidation of the Jews. We will take this up at greater length in our next show, finishing up the reading of this Yasha Levine article and also discussing the conclusion of his book, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. I will link to our program about Edwin Black's book, IBM and the Holocaust. And this will begin a series of programs about Surveillance Valley. And this concludes, For the Record, program number 1075, Surveillance Valley, Part 1, Eugenics, Racism, and High Tech. This is being recorded on June 11th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.